From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. I'm producer Megan Mack.
And I'm Evan Dawson. Let's open the podcast this week with a look at the conversation that sparked the most feedback on the program this week. It was about millennials, specifically millennials in the workplace.
The Wall Street Journal reports that some corporations have paid up to $20,000 an hour for consultants who can explain what millennials want at work. That might seem ridiculous.
It does.
And our panel of millennials agreed that there's too much generalizing. But they agreed on one thing. Millennials want to feel like their work is making a positive impact, even if they have to make less money.
All right, so let's listen to the comments from Annalise of Greater Rochester Enterprise, Seth Eshelman, founder of a company called Stash, and Andre Primus, the founder of RockShare.
I work for a nonprofit. I very well could go into the private sector and probably make more money, but I like working for an organization that has a mission, which I'm passionate about. So.
Yeah, we find the same thing. We have people interviewing for jobs, and you know, Stash has a policy of paying a living wage for any starting employee as part of our values of the organization. But beyond that, we have people who just openly say in an interview, I'm not sure where the salary range is, but I really love the values that your company embodies, and I want to be part of it. So how can I do that? And it's just totally unprompted. So it's interesting to see that shift that, people aren't, the bottom dollar obviously still buys you food and, puts a roof over your head. But it's interesting to see people weighing values over dollars.
What's a living wage, by the way?
Currently at Stash, I believe I'd have to check with our paychecks representative, but I think our current living wage that we're paying for single in this county is, around 16, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. It may have just shifted, but I'm pretty sure it's close to that.
Andre Primus, some thoughts there?
Well, I think that, if people are going to be weighing these things, this is a group of people who they started entering the workforce when there weren't any jobs. And if there are very few jobs and they're all low paying, you may as well take one that you want to do. And so as, more and more jobs appear, people still have that attitude. If I have all these different jobs, why not do the one that I want to do? And so I think that that is an unintended positive side effect of an initial jobs market that wasn't great.
Now let's turn to a story about a woman you've probably never heard of, but you should. Her name is Irene Gossin. In 1971, Irene became the first woman ever elected to an executive political office in Monroe County history. She won a race for Penfield Town Supervisor, and she would go on to serve 5 terms.
Irene became politically active because she was concerned that there was too much development covering up wetlands and green space. She fought to preserve the wetlands and parks near Arunacoy Bay. In many ways, Irene Gossin was one of our area's first environmentalists.
50 years after she began her fight, another Penfield woman is pushing back against development. Mindy McLaren bought 18 acres of land along 5 Mile Line Road to prevent it from becoming just another housing subdivision. McLaren has named that land the Irene L. Gossin Nature Preserve, and in 2018, it will open with hiking trails and a nature center.
Irene Gossin is now 97 years old, and I asked her what she thinks about having a park named after her.
I'm just very surprised and pleased at the attention this is being given. Good many people would never have the chance to enjoy those times if there weren't people out there fighting to keep them that way. Keep them natural. You don't have to build everything on top of everything. And live a little more natural life. It's a beautiful life. I'm the one that's the lucky one.
Let's turn our attention to a controversy now in the Rochester City School District, the new code of conduct. At the heart of the controversy is how students are disciplined.
The new code calls for fewer suspensions and an approach known as restorative justice. But the president of the Rochester Teachers Association, Adam Urbanski, says that requires dozens more staff and more funding support.
We welcomed Adam Urbanski and school board member Mary Adams. They agree that restorative justice is a good idea, but they disagree about whether the city is ready to implement it.
All these things are in the code of conduct in an aspirational way. In other words, let's do this and then hopefully we will get all of that. I'm saying districts that tried that failed miserably and made a bad situation even worse.
Okay, so let me ask Mary and Kit to weigh in on that. Mary first, why then, if Adam is right about that, why go forward with this until all of those additional supports are in place? In other words, if there is a widespread agreement that the code of conduct proposals are good ideas, why try to roll them out until all of those supports that might help them succeed are there? Why do it at all?
Well, what I would say is that we worked very hard in the budget to prioritize the most crucial supports that are needed. And ironically, speaking with Dr. Urbanski, one of the things that I advocated, and I'm, you know, very committed to the task force work, I advocated that we make sure that we keep school level staffing, general staffing, adequate teacher ratios, student-teacher ratios. There's always room for more improvement. There is a huge amount of resources. I wish that Dr. Urbanski or I actually could answer the question, what is the price tag of the full, complete, perfect package of supports? We know that it is way beyond what we have. Many of us have advocated, continue to advocate for more resources from multiple sources in order to fund a fuller package. But we have many supports in place that were not in place last year. And one more technical point. When we budget, we're responsible to budget only the revenues that we have in place at the time that we develop the budget. We know that we will have significant increases in resources from school improvement grants, which will become available over the summer in terms of the commitments to fund to have access to that revenue. We, as a district, have said repeatedly, Linda Simmons, our interim superintendent, that will be a major priority. School-based social-emotional supports, things that Dr. Urbanski is talking about that are needed, those will be funded further than they already are. And there definitely are in place restorative practices. There are staff, multiple staff, certified teachers who have been budgeted already to do restorative practices training and implementation. I'm the last one, though, to argue that we have enough and, you know, make some kind of platitude about, you know, rolling up your sleeves and doing with what you have. I absolutely acknowledge the need for more resources, and we need to work collectively to secure those.
But you'll still vote to go forward with this without the additional resources that you say are needed?
Yes, because there are always going to be additional resources needed. And the question is, where's the line? And as much as there are stories of, you know, disastrous things where a code was pushed through quickly, those situations did not have the kind of community process and the community commitment. And when I say community commitment, I don't mean an abstraction. I mean individuals with expertise from every area, youth leaders, not youth figureheads, youth leaders. People with real expertise in nonviolence and with restorative practices, expertise in youth development, social services, teachers, administrators, and so forth around the table who are not just recommending and prescribing. They are actually implementing, and we already are implementing, not poised to implement. So it is an ongoing process. There already is implementation underway. The code is, I think, can best be seen as the board's codification of some, and it is aspirational, but it also needs to become board policy.
In other words, though, we wouldn't be going from 0 to 60 on this.
Absolutely not. And I would note there's more than 10,000 suspensions this year.
Okay.
At this point.
And before I turn to Kip for some thoughts on this, I know, Adam, you were saying you want to jump back in.
Yeah, I want to say that there really is little, if any, disagreement on the intent as to where we want to be. I think the debate is on how to best get there. Here's the choice that we have. We can push ahead anyway and implement this called district-wide and hope for the best without the resources. Or we can implement this only in schools where we can afford to put those resources and take a phased-in approach to the same goal, to the shared goal that we have.
The Board of Education will vote on the new Code of Conduct on June 23rd.
For the first time in weeks, we had the chance this week to talk at length to a local Republican leader about the scandal everyone's been talking about. Anthony Danielli is the president of the Monroe County Legislature. Democrats have called on him to approve an investigation into what happened with the Comita and I-Square scandal.
Democrats have been particularly concerned with Justin Roy. He was the aide to County Executive Cheryl DeNolfo, who lost his job after DeNolfo said that Roy lied about his role in the scandal. Various reports indicate that Roy has a new job.
And that job is with a firm run by a Comita board member. Democrats say it's all too convenient. It looks like a political favor, a soft landing for a guy who took the fall. I asked Danielli if he agrees. Do you have any concern that someone who was engaged in what everyone sort of agrees now was a political hit job, a month after losing that job, gets a high-paying job through a Comita board member. Do you have any concern about that?
Again, Evan, you know, we're talking, this is a small town. We have a lot of boards and commissions in the community. I mean, I've had this conversation with other people privately where it is very, very difficult in the business community not to keep bumping into each other. And I am not, you know, first of all, I don't know if it's a high-paying job. I have heard that he was hired by Popley. You know, he certainly has a background that would qualify him to work for any engineering firm in the community. And I can tell you that if you've got a different job at a or the same job at a different engineering firm, odds are good that one of the executives of that firm sits on a board somewhere in the community. I'm not sure that, you know, the board member had anything specifically to do with the hiring. I guess I'm not sure that they didn't, but I do, you know, I don't see, I think that's reaching for straws. I think it's, you know, whether I don't think it's inappropriate, you know, if it were to come out that, you know, Justin did get a job at you know, at one of the authorities, I think that's a different conversation.
Okay. Would you think it's inappropriate if Justin, in the crossfire of all of this stuff with iSquare and Comita, was told privately, hey, somebody's got to take the fall, but you will get a job. We'll take care of you. That's what some taxpayers think happened. I have no evidence that that happened. But can you understand, two questions here. Can you understand why taxpayers would be cynical about it? And if that were the case, would that be a problem?
Again, I mean, that's pretty presumptuous. I don't believe that that's what happened. Again, I have no way to know for certain that that didn't happen. But as I said, I know, or from what I've heard, Justin put his resume out there. I mean, he has a family and he was looking to replace his income.
But a lot of people are unemployed, somewhere. Anthony. A lot of people don't have jobs. There's a lot of people who are probably qualified for certain jobs. I mean, the implication is that Justin's the only guy who was qualified for that job. And isn't that also presumptuous?
No, I don't think that's the implication. I think the implication is Justin went out, he applied for jobs in a lot of different places, probably interviewed with a lot of different places and got an offer from this engineering firm and thought that was a good job. And the engineering firm thought, you know, that he was qualified individual for that job. I mean, you know, I think it's speculation. Can I appreciate the fact that some folks in the public could, you know, make up a scenario that sounds unethical? Sure, I can understand that. But again, you know, I think this has kind of turned into a little bit of a witch hunt, and people are making up stories and, you know, stretching far, far outside the limits of, you know, what makes sense. I mean, you know, we can make up a lot of stories here and implicate a lot of different people, and I don't see that.
Democrats say they're waiting to hear if the AG's office will conduct its own investigation.
Let's finish the week with a drink. Some wine, some rosé would be fitting.
Yeah, we previewed one of the best events of the year for the Finger Lakes wine industry. It's called the Rosé Soirée. But I want to focus on an interesting question that came from a listener. We had three winemakers on the show, Kelby Russell from Red Newt, Julia Hoyle from Sheldrake Point, and Peter Beecraft of Anthony Road. And a listener wanted to know if climate change is already impacting the Finger Lakes wine industry. The first answer comes from Kelby Russell, who explains that climate change is not a future threat to his industry.
It's definitely having an impact. I mean, things are warmer. We're dealing with warmer years than we used to, which, you know, on net, we probably wouldn't complain about. I think the thing that when we're talking about climate change, when you see articles on it, the thing that's really scary is the extremes. It's the swings that are the bigger issue for the wine industry compared to sort of a long-term trend. So it's not so much that we're thinking about planting, you know, more Syrah in the Finger Lakes right now. It's more that, you know, we can have a nice mild winter and then all of a sudden have a minus 15 degree night out of nowhere. Or, you know, we can have a stretch of weather in March for 2 weeks where it's in the 70s and 80s and all of a sudden we have to worry about bud break, you know, 6 weeks ahead of the last frost date. So if anything, it's adding to apprehension. I mean, it'd be nice if we were just warming up so much that it wasn't an issue, or I mean, maybe that wouldn't be nice. But, you know, it's kind of putting us into a little bit more of a danger zone sometimes.
Julia?
Yeah, I guess just quickly adding to that, I feel like no one, you know, you talk to people that have been farming, whether it's grapes or just other crops, and multiple times I've heard people just say, you don't know what the normal is anymore. What is norm? What is the normal for growing grapes? You know, what weather should you expect? And nobody really seems to know. We are not, sort of going off of Emily's question, we're not necessarily having drought issues in the way that you would hear about grape growing regions on the West Coast. We have plenty of water. But what is normal for us in a growing season is not really known, just kind of rolling with the punches.
Peter Beecraft?
Yeah. Duck and move. Duck and move like a boxer.
The Rosé Soirée is Saturday, June 4th in Geneva.
That's it for this edition of Week on Connections, the podcast. You can listen to Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
And you can always find us on the WXXI mobile app. Have a wonderful weekend. I'm Evan Dawson.
I'm Megan Mack. We'll see you Monday.